Chapter 4. Growling Bellies. Drizzt turned a corner and sprinted ahead, a horde of angry enemies close behind. He turned back and let fly an arrow, silencing one loud-mouthed orc. But then he had to dive down to the side, roll right back to his feet, and turn another corner as a volley of spears and large rocks flew out at him. A sharp corner, and Drizzt found himself face to belly with a huge ogre. Without hesitating, the drow leaned backward, all the while his feet propelling him forward. He saw the ogre's club descending, chasing, but he was the quicker, stabbing right up into the ogre's groin. How the brute hopped, and when it landed, Drizzt was behind it, launching into a circuit, scimitars slashing the back of the brute's thigh one after another. On Drizzt ran, and he couldn't help but smile when he heard the commotion as his pursuers turned the corner and no doubt stumbled right into the howling ogre. One more turn in the corridor had the drow in his last run, the metal wall in front of him set with a metal grate in the direct center. Never slowing, he sheathed his blades and pulled out Tolmeril, knocked an arrow, and let fly. The magical arrow struck a bar of the metal grate, sparks flying everywhere, briefly illuminating the wall. Drizzt heard the metal screeching as it slid aside, and as he neared, he heard the dwarves calling out. A torch came up behind the hole in the wall, the center place where the grate had been, lighting the way for Drizzt to dive through, hardly slowing. As soon as he rolled out of the way, the dwarf brigade slid a ballista in place, a strange thick spear set to throw. "Go," he told them, knowing the monsters to be close behind. Off went the spear, whipping down the hall and crashing into the nearest enemies. The hollow missile collapsed in on itself, spraying hot pitch all around. Howls echoed down the hall, and how the dwarves laughed and patted one another on the back as they slammed and hammered a solid plate back into the wider metal wall that sealed the corridor. "The next plate's ready in the fourth southern chamber," one yellow-bearded fellow said to Drizzt, "if you're meaning to go right back." "Enough for today," Drizzt replied. He had been forced to call upon Guinevere out there in the upper dark. "Tomorrow, perhaps." The yellow-bearded dwarf tilted his head and stared curiously at the drow. "Hey, elf?" he asked. "No sign, then?" Drizzt could only shrug. After being chased back into Mithril Hall from the rim of Keeper's Dale, the dwarves had turned their attention back to the lower tunnels. At Brunner's request and Conrad's bidding, they had developed a system of opening up their barriers, just a bit and just for a few moments, so that Drizzt could go out and scout around the tunnels. They were more than halfway through the month of Hammer now, the first month of 1485, and Drizzt had been out several times. He had found no sign of Wulfgar and Regis, no sign of anything except that the monsters were here, orcs and ogres and goblins and drow. And their noose, if today was any indication, was tightening around Mithril Hall. Brunner and Conrad had been discussing the possibility of trying to break out into the tunnels, perhaps to come back to the surface just beyond the Cerbrin in the east, then turn back and break the siege from without. From what Drizzt had seen of the countless camps and the ordered garrisons, that was just what the enemy wanted. They weren't going to break out through the upper dark without heavy losses. And if Wulfgar and Regis were still down there, they weren't getting anywhere near Mithril Hall. That thought proved most unsettling to the drow, for given the abundance of dark elves he had noted in the tunnels, it was clear to him that if Wulfgar and Regis were anywhere near this region in the Underdark, they were either dead or imprisoned. He put his face in his hands and breathed a deep and steadying sigh, trying to hold out hope for his friends, but also preparing himself for the very real possibility that he would never see them again, alive or dead, and that he, Catti Bree, and Brunner would never learn of their fate. A line of dwarves moved through the large iron door and into the reinforced vault Citadel Adbar used as a larder, bending low against the tug of heavy ropes as they towed a trio of large carts.
400 pounds in each,
remarked Nigel Thunderstorm, of the Felbar Thunderstorms, a family known for its culinary skills. Nigel had come to Adbar some 50 years before, accepting the invitation of King Harbram to serve as his personal chef. It was supposed to be a temporary position, with Nigel expected to return to Felbar when his ma, Nigella, retired. But in Adbar he had found a home and a wife, and now two children besides. His life had been busy and good, his reputation another high mark for the Thunderstorms, whose family tree boasted chefs and brewers in many dwarven communities around Faerûn. And now, with the winter weighing heavily on the besieged citadel, King Harnoth leaned on Nigel even more, affording him the responsibilities of rationing. Any mistakes Nigel made would cost dwarves their lives, given the state of the pantries. He directed his fellows around the larder, choosing ingredients to pad the meager portions.
"Lots of spice," he kept muttering,
for a strong taste could help mitigate the lack of volume. The band had just begun to load their sacks when the first dwarf cried out in shock and pain. All eyes went to him, staring at him as he staggered around, then looking past him to a most unwelcome sight. A dark elf holding a hand crossbow.
"To arms, guards!" the cries went up, and the dwarves didn't wait for reinforcements to arrive through the tunnel, but charged ahead, wielding spoons and ladles and anything else they could find to chase this intruder away.
Nigel Thunderstorm hopped about, trying to make sense of it all. A drow in his larders? How? The tunnels were sealed. His thoughts were still spinning when battle was joined, and a dozen more dark elves appeared, stepping from invisibility, firing off their poison bolts and drawing swords to meet the dwarven charge. A lightning bolt brightened the cavern, rebounding off several stalagmite beams. Three dwarves went down beneath it, jolting on the floor in uncontrollable spasms. The drow were running then, but not really retreating, it seemed to Nigel. More likely, they were staying away from the ferocious dwarves, reloading as they went and launching hand crossbow bolts back at their pursuers.
"Formations!" Nigel screamed.
The notion came to him that the dark elves were using the dwarves' aggressiveness against them, were splitting them up to catch them in a side battle with favorable odds.
"Tighten it up, I say!"
Nigel went on, calling out specific names to bring back wayward dwarves too eager in their pursuit. Drums and horns and growing torchlight from the tunnel brought hope. Aye, the Legion had arrived, and the drow would be slaughtered. Still, Nigel couldn't believe they were in here. How had they gotten past the guards, and why in this place? The sound of sudden and desperate coughing turned him to the right-hand wall of the larder, and there he found some answers. A magical green cloud had come roiling up, sending his dwarves staggering away, many vomiting, some crawling, all gasping. But Nigel looked past those unfortunate fellows, and to the great bins stacked by the wall, full of grains, and now full too with some noxious and poisonous cloud. Across the way came a similar unwelcome sound, and a second cloud appeared around the salted meats and fungi.
"Ah, ye dogs!"
Nigel muttered, shaking his hairy head in disbelief. There was no fighting to be heard in the larder then, and Nigel could spot no dark elves, nor could any other dwarves, given the way they were moving about and looking around in confusion.
"Ah, got 'em!"
cried a dwarf at the far end of the hall, and two formations went running that way, Nigel in close pursuit. They saw the caller come staggering back, a pair of hand crossbow darts in his chubby face, and with his chest torn open by the slash of a drow blade. Beyond him, the dwarves saw the retreating dark elves along a tunnel that had not been there before. A magical tunnel, a passwall spell, and the dwarves could only look on helplessly as the wall reformed, sealing them off from the drow. Behind them, the coughing and gasping and spitting continued, and the noxious clouds roiled around the largest pile of stores. The clouds ruined a good portion of Citadel Adbar's food supply. Driz spotted Catti Bree walking along a wide corridor in the upper section of Mithril Hall. He started to call out to her, but paused, noting her dress. She wore her basic tan breeches, but Driz hardly noticed. Her light purple blouse was of the finest material, with colors shifting so that even from this distance, even in this somewhat dim torchlight, the shirt made her beautiful eyes seem all the bluer. The untucked shirt reached below her waist, to mid-thigh, but its sleeves barely reached the woman's elbows and were tied off there, leaving her forearms and her two distinctive spell scars, one the symbol of Mistra,
the other a unicorn's head in homage to Mieliki, clear to see. The curiosity of that gave Drizzt pause, for it was the first time Drizzt had seen the woman publicly bearing her forearms and those spell scars. Something else, though, had him even more off balance, and it took him a long while to put his finger on it. This shirt, he realized, and lost his breath. He hadn't seen this particular garment in a century. It had belonged to the gnome called Jack, or Jaculi, a most wicked little trickster, trained by Illithids and in league with Clan Kurok. A band of marauding half-ogres. Drizzt had put an end to Jack the gnome and had claimed the robes, that very shirt as properly gotten loot. Not dirt, not grime, not spilled blood could stain the fabulous, clearly magical garment, nor could the ravages of time affect it, apparently. Catti Bree had been buried in that shirt a century before. Under stones in the cairn in Mithril Hall, covering the decomposing body, the realization rattled Drizzt to his very heart. She was wearing the shirt she had been buried in. She had visited her own grave. He tried to call out to her, but swallowed hard, unable to get the words past the lump in his throat. He started running instead and caught up to her, his hands trembling as he grasped her shoulders, and his dumbstruck expression revealing all the fears and doubts. Catti Bree tugged him close, her composure collapsing now that she had found someone to hug.
"You went there," Drizzt whispered to her.
"I had to."
"How did you? Why did you?"
"The stones," Drizzt stammered. "Athrogate helped me," Catti Bree explained.
"I was here," said Drizzt,
pushing her back to arm's length.
"Brunner was here. We would have accompanied."
Catti Bree shook her head solemnly, denying the notion outright.
"I could not have borne your own tears mixing with mine," she explained. "Athrogate was unbothered. He did not know the Catti Bree who was, and hardly knows the Catti Bree who is. He found the whole trip to the graveyard perfectly amusing, worthy of a song even."
"That was likely the most trying part of the trip," Drizzt said lightheartedly.
But Catti Bree didn't agree, as much as she clearly wanted to. She tried to say no, but no sound came forth, and her eyes welled up, thick with tears. Drizzt pulled her close for another hug. He couldn't imagine what it must have been like for the woman, to go to her own grave, to see her own rotted corpse, to take the burial shirt from it even. How could she have summoned the strength to do such a thing? Why had she done such a thing? This time it was Catti Bree who broke the clench, pulling back from Drizzt, sniffling hard to clear teary mucus and blowing out a hard breath to steady herself.
"Why?" Drizzt asked.
"To make it real," she replied. "To make it more than an exercise of thought."
"Why the shirt?"
"Because it's mine. A part of Catti Bree. Given to her, to me, by my husband. And it is magical and powerful, beyond its ability to remain clean of all dirt and stains."
"What do you know?"
"I studied at the Ivy Mansion. And when I was there, I happened upon some magical texts about such robes as this. Well, a blouse for me, but a robe to Jack the Gnome. Like the ring you gave to me, it is more than it seems. Most of its powers are subtle, particularly when it is worn by a fledgling wizard, as I was before the advent of the spell plague. But now I understand."
Drizzt looked at her curiously.
"Are you saying you went to the grave to retrieve the rope?
"Partly,"
she admitted, but unconvincingly. It was clear to Drizzt that her primary goal in opening that cairn,
was to find a tangible reality to the supernatural experiences that had befallen her. It is a tool in our fight, and I'd be a sorry battle hammer if I shied from something helpful out of weak feelings. Wearing it, I am armored from sword and from spell, particularly from spells. Wearing it, my own spells resound more powerfully. Perhaps this blouse, this robe of the Archmagi, will make my fireball take down the giant right before the giant cuts down my husband. Surely that is a risk that was worth the cost.
The cost? The words made Catti Bree wince.
Yes, there had indeed been a cost to the woman for visiting that grave and reclaiming the fabulous garment of Jack the Gnome. Her lips moved as she tried to elaborate, but Drizzt didn't let her go there again, instead pulling her close for another hug, one that ended the discussion, one that would, hopefully, allow Catti Bree to put the cairn, her grave, behind her now, once and for all.
King Emerus Warcrown lost his breath in the icy wind when he went out through the secret door on the western face of the Rauven Mountains, that 30th day of the month of Hammer, in the year of the Iron Dwarf's vengeance. He bent low and drove into the raging blizzard, and what a storm it was! It had only begun a couple of hours before, but already the blowing snow reached to the dwarf's knees. He plowed through, leading his army. The snow was not a deterrent to them. The desperate dwarves of Felbar had been waiting for a storm such as this to cover their exit through the new tunnel they had dug, through the new wide door leading them into the cold vale. The sun had not yet risen, and even when it did, they knew that the darkness would not substantially lighten. But under the weight of this storm and under the magical clouds of the darkened sky, they hoped to escape. They knew their way, due west. For this exit location had been chosen for that very reason. It would lead them straight to the main orc encampment. Whispering to hold tight to their formation, for to be separated here were surely to be lost and killed by the fury of the storm. The bulk of Felbar's garrison, all but that minimal number of dwarves needed to secure the lower tunnels, scarred the new fallen and new falling snow with their determined march. Just a short while later, perhaps no more than 100 yards from the mountain exit, though it was no longer visible to the dwarves, they saw the first lights of campfires.
"Make your growls come from your mouths now, boys! Enough from the bellies, I say!" King Emerus addressed his charges, moving with determination among the ranks. "Remember them ye got in the halls! Too many mouths and not enough food! Ye think on that and stand straighter, me boys, and me girls!" he added playfully, as he moved past Fist and Fury, the Fellhammer sisters, who were eager as always for the coming fight. "Less'll die out here than in the halls if we're sittin' and waitin'," Emerus reminded them. "And better to die in battle than in bed, I say!" He raised his voice as he finished, and motioned for that to be echoed up and down the formation. "Now, me boys," Emerus yelled, 100 steps to our enemies, and let them know the steel of Felbar!" And off they went into a full charge, howling back at the howling wind, every step kicking snow that was caught in the raging storm and twisted around them. In that howl, in that storm, in that darkness, came to the orcs a louder roar and a deeper and more solid darkness, as the Felbar legions hit the orc camp in full charge, running over sentries huddling low in their furs, sentries barely noting the approach of a dwarf army in this terrible blizzard. Some managed to scream out in warning, most managed only to yelp in surprise before the dwarven wall plowed them under. Axes took out tent poles, swords poked through the fabric, heavy boots stomped anything that moved. Orcs and goblins died by the dozen, by the score, by the hundreds, before any organized defense rose up against the boys of Felbar, and even then the dwarven momentum was too great, the bloodlust too entrenched. In the east beyond the Rauvens, the sky brightened with dawn, and King Emerus knew hope when he looked at the blood-soaked ground around him, snow piling on bodies, almost all of them goblin kin.
But very quickly, Emerus's hope turned to dismay, for their great victory, their great slaughter, had barely touched the depth of this encampment, and now in front of them the goblin kin tightened their ranks, and behind them the frost giants lifted their boulders.
"Fight on!" Emerus cried,
and Ragged Dane and Parson Glaive cried beside him, and all the dwarves of Felbar roared and doubled their charge. Only now it was a battle and no longer a slaughter, a pitched battle where the shield lines disintegrated into a wild brawl in short order. Caring not at all for their orc allies, the giants flung their huge rocks into the melee with impunity. They couldn't see their specific targets in the wild storm, of course. King Emerus could hardly make out goblin from orc from dwarf, and more than once held his breath as his mighty sword swept ahead, hoping that it was no ally at the end of the blade. It would be forever after known as the Battle of Midwinter, on a field in the Cold Vale not 2 miles from the pond where King Brom of Adbar had fallen, in the midst of the greatest storm of that brutal season. 3,000 goblin kin, mostly orcs, died that day in the piling snow, and a score of giants fell beside them. But it wasn't enough. Wise old King Emerus understood it immediately in the first wild volleys of the pitched battle, some halfway through the orc encampment. The wind and the snow, the orcs and the goblins, and those awful giants, who did not shy from any wintry weather, halted the charge and the momentum, and not the power of Emerus's finest, 7 of the 10 dwarven legions of Citadel Felbar, nearly 3,000 battle-hardened dwarves, could drive them away.
"Press on, me king!" Ragged Dane implored the old dwarf. "We'll take em to the land of the dead!"
"And ourselves," Emerus replied under his breath. Still, despite the clear disaster unfolding here, despite his every instinct telling him that they could not win, King Emerus almost rallied his charges and pressed into the thicker wall. Behind them loomed the other dwarves of Felbar, hungry in their dark holes, trapped above and below. This was their chance, their break. They had to get out, get to the Glimmerwood, perhaps, and find some way to turn either west to Mithril Hall or north to battered Adbar. But they could not. Like the boys of Mithril Hall a month earlier, the dwarves of Felbar found nothing in front of them but certain doom, and nothing behind them but starvation. Except they were not alone, King Emerus reminded himself. This was not the only chance, the last desperate stand. Mithril Hall remained, and Adbar too, and perhaps from the south would come relief from Everlund and Silvery Moon. His doubts of that had led him here, and still they lingered, but in the face of this utter defeat, he wisely cast aside those doubts.
"Turn him home," he told Ragged Dane and Parson Glaive. "Me king?" Ragged Dane asked in surprise, but Parson Glaive was nodding.
The battle lines rolled back to the east, back to the foothills and the new gate, the second rune gate, that the dwarves of Felbar had dug and the clerics of Felbar had enchanted. They got back in, staggering, stumbling, most bleeding from many wounds, and the last group to leave the battlefield was the entourage of King Emerus himself, Ragged Dane and Parson Glaive beside him, and with Fist and Fury scoring the last kills of the day, the sisters taking down a pair of orcs that foolishly chased Emerus to the gate. In rolled the dwarves, rambling along their tunnels, and the orcs and giants saw the open doors in front of them and eagerly pursued. They did not understand the power of dwarven rune gates. Barely 5 running strides in, Emerus and his band only a few steps ahead of them, the first of the magical glyphs exploded, fire and lightning filling the entryway, laying low orc and giant alike. Stubbornly, another monstrous force pressed on, stepping over the bodies of their fallen kin, and ultimately invoking the last of the magical glyphs, the ones designed to swing shut those heavy stone doors. And as they closed, squashing bodies and pressing back giants with ease, a huge iron locking bar fell into place behind them, sealing the tunnel from the storm, and the storm of monsters without. And sealing in 2 surprised orcs. King Emerus led the sudden turn, and his sword struck the first blow in the final slaughter of the day.